Welcome to episode 4 of the Interspecies Future podcast. I'm your host, Bridie Addison Child. Interspecies Future is an initiative by Berlin-based art foundation LAS, marking the beginning of a multi-decade civilizational journey in advancing the new rights and opportunities for non-human life on Earth, as made possible by the emergence of planetary-scale computing. This episode, we're talking about AI and collective intelligence, and asking how AI might drive a new relationship between humans and other species. This episode, I was joined by Blaise Aguera-Iacas and Kate Devlin. Our conversation ranged wildly from how we can define intelligence in AI to the potential to communicate with other species, and to how visions for the future are inevitably saturated by influence from the past.
You know, there's still people expecting that we're going to have replicant versions of ourselves technologically, because we've been set up to expect that through hundreds of years of stories about it.
The entire project of progress relies on expressing ideas in languages that are themselves saturated in the very biases that we're trying to push against. And that inherent contradiction in progress is something that AI brings us face to face with.
Thank you both so much for joining me. Could you please introduce yourselves?
I'm Dr. Kate Devlin. I'm reader in AI and Society at King's College London.
And I'm Blaise Aguera-Iacas, a VP and fellow in Google Research.
So we're starting with this idea that AI can drive a new relationship between humans and non-humans or non-human animals. And I thought it would be interesting, before we think about what that relationship could be, to think about what it has been, because the development of machine intelligence is already really intertwined with our kind of construction and concept of nature. So what is the history of the relationship between humans, non-humans, and technology?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to be involved with a project called AI Narratives and wrote a chapter in a volume for that. And also looking at how we tell stories about AI and about robotics over time and how those have changed from Greek myths right through to sci-fi movies today. And one of the really interesting things for me was, I used to be an archaeologist many years ago, and so I'm very interested in the way that we understand the world and the impact we make on it and the things that we create. And in the Middle Ages, there was this idea of machina mundi, the clockwork world, where the idea was there was a divine creator, there was God, and God created this perfectly harmonious universe where all the spheres moved together celestially, that where everything was organized, where everything took the correct path and everything had its place, and it was divinely created. And from that, that was first mentioned, I think it was Sacro Bosco in sort of 1300s. After that, we see at the time of the Renaissance, we see this kind of thing coming back again as people start creating things like automata. And when they build automata, the idea was that you couldn't perfectly replicate nature, you could only imitate it through these things. So there was this whole construct there as well that, you know, we're trying to create something like the duck, for example, a robotic metal duck. It wasn't really robotic. It was, you know, you could feed it bread and it would poo at the other end. And this idea that you'd created this piece of nature, but of course it was an artifice. And there's lots of stories around that, lots of stories about automata in the form of birds or monkeys or ducks, or, you know, these stories abound of us trying to create these imitations of nature, but they always have their place as imitations. They're never seen as being as valid as nature. There was the idea there always that there was this divine creation that had everything in its right place.
There's one case of a historical automaton, though, that strikes me as sort of special in this regard, which is not the Mechanical Turk itself, but the voice box of the Mechanical Turk. Do you know this story, Kate?
There's a flute player one as well. I know about the flute player. So is that related to that kind of thing?
I think that one was also made by Kempelen.
Yeah, I think it was.
You know, I mean, everybody knows about the Mechanical Turk and the small person hidden inside pretending to be a robot playing chess. But the part that fewer people know is that obviously a part of playing chess is you have to be able to say check and mate. And so he needed a robotic voice basically in order to do this. And obviously, if the person tries to make that, you know, to make that utterance, it would not sound robotic enough. So, you know, you have kind of an opposite of the Turing test sort of problem to solve here, where you have to make a machinic voice. Kempelen added a box that would imitate the vocal tract that would say check. But the vocal tract that Kempelen made, you know, it's sort of a bellows with various parts that sort of imitate the various parts of the vocal tract and the vocal cords and so on, and could be worked by hand. That turned out to obsess him. He only took about 6 months to build the Mechanical Turk, but he took the next 20 years working on this vocal tract part and ended up writing a giant monograph on speech and the production of speech, using this as a model. And that, you know, in effect was the first voter, right, in the voter vocoder sort of sense. So what I really like about that work of Kempelen's is that it's unlike the you know, Vocation's Digesting Duck or something like this. It wasn't just something to fool people, you know, into, you know, it wasn't just a piece of artifice. It was a model. It was a real model of the vocal tract and a functional model, right, of what of how the different parts of it deform in order to produce speech sounds. And the reason that this was worthy of 20 years of his time and that he published on it and that it was you know, important posthumously as well, is because as a model, it you know, its utility had, you know, was much greater than as a parlor trick. I mean, that those same kinds of vocal tract models powered the secret telephones in World War II, the STU, the secure telephone units, and so on, that would encode speech in you know, in different frequency bands and encrypt them and send them you know, overseas. So modeling for me is where things take the turn from being just about, you know, imitating nature to actually, you know, making a clockwork that models something specific about nature.
That's fascinating. That's incredible.
Yeah, and I think we will come back to some of those themes around modeling, because I'm really, really interested to talk more about that and language modeling. But if we just dig a little bit more into this idea of historical context, because Kate, as you said, you were an archaeologist, and Blaise, you have a recent book called Ubi Sunt, and in it you mention like the various ways that we draw from the past. You use the Latin phrase, where are those who were before us? So what are we bringing from the past into our development of AI now? And what does that imply about the future of it?
Well, that's a really interesting question. For me, it's a really rich field to be able to draw upon, to look at the past and to see the incredible things that have happened before, because as it turns out, of course, there's nothing new under the sun, and probably we've tried some version of something already. But it's what I find really valuable is looking at the reception that these things have had as we progress, and the kind of historical context that shapes the things that we've invented. So to look now at AI and see the way it's going, if we reflect on the state of things now, what has led us to this point? We can look at all the sci-fi we've consumed over the years. We can see what our expectations are. You know, there's still people expecting that we're going to have replicant versions of ourselves technologically, because we've been set up to expect that through hundreds of years of stories about it, even though the closest we've got is a robot vacuum cleaner scurrying across the floor. That's as far as we've got to our domestic robots, for example. So I think it's really interesting, and when we look at the idea of AI interacting with nature and with the natural world, that's quite telling to examine as well. So like this concept of how people view nature in the past, if we look now at what we expect, we're sitting in the middle of a climate crisis. We know we have to act to do certain things very, very quickly. Can we use our AI as a tool for good? And there's lots of stories about that, about how we can use AI. And some of them are really, really groundbreaking and amazing, you know, sort of like satellite monitoring automatically of things like algal bloom or of deforestation. We have AI being used in agriculture to look at optimum planting time, optimum harvesting time, which will increase crop yields. At the same time, we have to be, and we're choosing often to turn a blind eye to the fact that we are part of the problem, that AI is causing a large carbon footprint itself. So, you know, we've got to evaluate whether or not that is a necessity. Can we justify the things we're doing given the damage that we're also causing? And I think that's something we have to question, is the sustainability of all of this, because it's not just the server farms and training these algorithms. It's also things in the whole production process, like the hardware of the computers, like the mining of cobalt for electric batteries. These things are all having a huge, huge impact. So while we can say, look, we want to use AI for as a force for good when it comes to nature and on humans, we also have to recognize that we have a lot of responsibility on ourselves as well to do so in a sustainable way.
I agree with that. I'm also hopeful about large foundation models in this regard, actually, for reasons that haven't been discussed much. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about how they're big and therefore their footprint, their training footprint is giant and so on. There hasn't been a lot of talk about the fact that once a foundation model is trained, it can be used to do anything. You know, the possibility for us to have, you know, single model that is kind of pluripotent and that can be used with local low power computation to do any kind of arbitrary task, including ones that require general intelligence, is one that excites me from an ecological standpoint. But taking maybe a little bit of a different angle on the history question, and thank you so much for bringing up Ubi Sunt, my novella. It was a bit of an under the radar thing, and I think very few people have read it. But you know, it is very much a historical meditation. I actually sort of came to it, you know, partly by reading this book by Susan Stewart called The Ruins Lesson. She is an art historian at Princeton and poet, and The Ruins Lesson is all about ruins and about the way the fragments of historical civilizations have been reinterpreted and re-understood by subsequent people, and especially the way there are these images that I found just incredibly powerful, especially since I read them when I was sick with COVID, and they were about the Angles and Saxons essentially living in an environment full of Roman ruins that looked like they had been built by giants, literally entagewerk, the work of giants. Giant Roman structures, you know, that dwarfed anything that they could build, and that seemed like they exceeded the craft of man, so it's literally like living in an alien in the ruins of an alien civilization, and what that must have been like. And I was relating this in a certain way to language, because in things like language models, one builds a representation of language using historical materials. The reason that Word2Vec and other similar sorts of early word representation techniques are saturated with bias in all of the ways that they are have everything to do with the fact that language cannot be divorced from all of the historical materials that constitute meanings in language. The way I put it in the book was that I was talking about Tolkien and his use of language. You know, why does Middle Earth have a racial hierarchy? Why does the term swarthy, meaning dark-skinned from the Old English swart or black, invariably describe the low, evil, and untrustworthy? Why are women so conspicuously absent from Tolkien's legendarium? And might it relate to the masculine and patriarchal defaults of Old English? As we excavate, we find that the spoils of old languages, hence all languages, because none are new, are saturated in bias, repression, bigotry, even hatred. As the One Ring is to Frodo, languages themselves are to Tolkien. And to us, the poisoned fruit we must eat, the unseaworthy ships on which our stories must sail, the rotten timbers roofing our mead halls. And my point is that the entire project of progress relies on expressing ideas in languages that are themselves saturated in the very biases that we're trying to push against. And that inherent contradiction in progress is something that, you know, that AI brings us face to face with.
That's so interesting. I love it. I think this is I've been doing recently work around AI and power and how this power is held and shaped. And the language thing was so very clear. I think even the very fact that we think language can be reduced to machine digestible words, when there are languages out there that can't be done in that way, but we just ignore them when we choose to primarily work in English and ignoring other people. I think there's just so much there, and there's so much exclusion going on because we see a default, and it's that same default that ends up with the same people shaping the tech all along and the other people being marginalized.
And Kate, how optimistic are you about that? Like, do you think that we can disrupt those power imbalances and kind of reset those power structures?
Big sigh, because I think we've got a long way to go. There's a willingness to do so, but some of this stuff is so ingrained, and we don't have all the methods to do it yet. But I think the very first step is we've reached the first step where we acknowledge that there is a problem. You know, since the kind of explosion in the AI ethics community, amount of research that's being done is testament to that. We can very clearly see these problems have arisen, these problems around bias, these problems around discrimination. So we are aware that it is there. We're currently in the stage where we're trying to work out how best to address that. There is not an easy way to do that. It may be that it can involve lots of approaches, including thinking very carefully about the data sets, because that bias can creep in anywhere, thinking very carefully about our algorithms, thinking about the level of explainability we need and whether or not that's possible. And then the regulation and governance aspect, which is just huge and unwieldy, and no one's really got the answer for it yet. So I think there is motivation to try and make it fairer, but we've still got a long way to go.
This brings us maybe in an interesting way to the whole question of languages in other species. You know, I just did an experiment a few days ago, or a couple of weeks ago now, with Lambda, with Google's large language model, in which I asked it to translate a sentence from Turkish into English. And I did it that way because I also wanted to ask it, you know, about gender neutrality, and to do it that way. And that worked as well. But anyway, it did it. It translated from Turkish into English. And what's so interesting about that is that, unlike a neural machine translation system, you know, Lambda is based on a foundation model that is just trained on, you know, in an unsupervised way on a big chunk of the web. You know, there's some Turkish on the web. It's not like Turkish is completely unrepresented, but there's a lot less of it than there is English, of course. And there are no parallel corpora. There's not a big primer, you know, with tons of sentences, you know, translated, you know, kind of set up in the way that one would want. For, you know, to explicitly train a translator. So the fact that just by throwing Turkish in alongside the English, the thing learns how to translate between Turkish and English is extremely interesting, because that suggests that an unsupervised model that just has thrown into its training umwelt the sounds that sperm whales make, or, you know, all kinds of sensors in rainforests, or weather systems, or any other thing that one might imagine, you know, it will learn about the translations or the correlations or the interrelationships among those things, and be able to talk about those with us in English. That's something that is not really possible for for humans to do in any sort of scalable way, because we are built in such a way that our universe, our world, is very specific to our environment, our own umwelt, right? So the same thing that is a weakness in unsupervised language models that means that they require 500,000 lifetimes of reading in order to learn how to read could be an extreme advantage. You know, it's always in low gear, but it can climb any hill, right, in some sense. So so that makes me really excited about the prospect of using large unsupervised models to translate in some very general sense between all of these different kinds of sensors or environments that may operate on very different timescales, may use very different modalities. Anything that we can transduce into an electrical signal, essentially, we can throw into models like this one and learn about them. And this makes me hopeful about other kinds of natural languages or natural signals that may be transducible in other ways, right? It may go beyond language. It may go to gesture and place and physical environment and other kinds of signals. There are obviously many, many species that communicate with odorants and with all kinds of other things as well. But all of that, in principle, can be transduced as well. We know it's transduced into electrical signals by animals of various kinds. Why not by technologies as well?
And with that tech, what would we do with that? What does the future of AI look like when we imagine non-human animals as stakeholders?
So I'm maybe not going to be thinking as grand as Blaise is on this, because I bet he's got some really good ideas. But I was going to say that one thing is to be able to establish baselines for behavior, for example, to look at where there is disruption to that, to be able to monitor for things causing issues and impacting on those animals. That would just be my first thought, that, you know, that's a really useful tool for AI right now, is to monitor how things are going. We know that a lot of areas face very rapid change, and to be able to see where that's happening and get a warning of that would be really, really helpful. So for me, that would make sense to do it that way.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think my answers are actually pretty simple. I mean, they fall in three buckets, which are science, engineering, and empathy. So, you know, from a science perspective, you know, understanding these patterns, this is all about building models. So, you know, why do we build models? First, we build models to understand. There are so many natural systems that we just, you know, have very, very imperfect understandings of, or no understanding of at all. And this kind of unsupervised learning will allow us to understand. And there's value in understanding alone. Then there is the engineering with that. I happen to believe that given the current state of the Earth, we're in a little bit of a, you know, you break it, you buy it kind of situation. We've broken it, but we haven't yet faced up to the realities of what that now requires of us. You know, having broken a lot of regulatory mechanisms, we now have to step in and begin to, you know, apply forms of resuscitation, right, or of control to planetary systems. Essentially, reintroduce homeostats where they were. I don't know what, you know, how radical this is going to have to get, how much geoengineering is going to be required. But, you know, anybody who makes an overly naturalistic, like, oh, you know, it's sacred, we can't touch it, or whatever, like, no, we've already, you know, had our paws all over this damn thing. You know, the idea that somehow now, you know, we can just stand back and see what happens is utterly irresponsible, in my opinion. So there's an engineering aspect to all of this that I think is also important. And finally, empathy. You know, if we are to expand the circle of empathy to planetary scale, then this kind of modeling needs to go beyond the kind of clinical, science and engineering sort of modeling and go to a more identity kind of modeling. And this is why, you know, these ideas about theory of mind, you know, with other species and with natural systems feels to me important, because only when we feel that are we going to really take seriously the project of us being the entire planet.
Yeah, you're talking there, Blaise, about just the importance of empathy and relationality. And Kate, in your book, Turned on Science, Sex and Robots, you write a lot about that. You write about intimacy and the ethics of consent and human sociality. And I loved your book, and I'd really love just to hear more about it. How do you conceive of our relationships with tech?
Yes, so it's been a very interesting research topic to explore. And I was very drawn to the way that humans are social creatures and that we look for that sociality in all our interactions, even when those interactions are with tech. So whether we're using a voice assistant, a printer, a robot vacuum cleaner, we establish some kind of relationship with that, and we turn our attention to it in a particular way. And we're always looking for any signs that there is a response, whether or not that response is sentient. And in most cases, of course, it won't be. So there are lots of questions that arise from that, especially when it comes to AI, in how we behave. Do we behave with a particular regard for another creature's feelings? If that creature isn't human, do we have to think about what we say to a piece of tech? Not because we're going to offend it in some way, but because it may have an impact on how we interact with others as well. What happens if we do ever create technology that has a form of sentience or consciousness, or would we even recognize that if it did arise? So there's a lot to kind of explore there in the way that we shape our interactions through our sociality.
I mean, that reminds me, you speak in the book as well about a collaborator of yours called Julie Carpenter, and she has a concept that our relationships with tech is a different kind of social category. And I'm wondering if you think we could apply that kind of thinking to non-human animals as well as machines.
I think we already do. And this is why it doesn't take much imagination to think that perhaps we have the same kind of relationships forming with our AIs or with our robotics, because we already treat each other in different sort of forms of social categorization as well, in the way that we code switch between different settings. And as Julie Carpenter pointed out with her work that she did looking at military robots and the way that military personnel interact with those, there is this new emergent form where we know the limitations, we're aware of the limitations of the technology, and yet we still form this bond. And I think we already do that with a lot of animals, for example. If we think about how we treat pets, we're perfectly aware off the limits of their understanding. We project a lot and hope that they understand a lot more than maybe they do, but who can really tell? And so that's a really obvious thing that we do. It comes from us. And yeah, I can see that being something that goes right across all forms of interaction. So I don't think it's any less real for being one-sided. So there is definitely a real relationship there, even if that relationship is not returned. So the way in which we treat tech or treat non-humans outside of the tech sphere, that tells us more about ourselves. And those feelings that we have and the intimacy that we create may come from ourselves. I mean, we may be projecting onto other creatures or other pieces of tech, but it's still valid. We're still feeling those reactions. We're still experiencing those emotions. So it can be both a real relationship and a one-sided relationship, in my opinion.
Yeah, we've spoken about communicating and relationality. And in many ways, we've really spoken about that being driven by the human, you know, relationships that we project onto other things. I wonder if maybe one thing we haven't fully explored is a kind of concept of intelligence in that. So yeah, I wonder if we can just think about that. In what ways is the intelligence that's present in humans and in animals and in AI different or the same? Can we consider them intelligent? And what does that mean about our relationships with them?
I will say at the outset, I agree wholeheartedly with Kate's perspective on this. I really loved the book Turned On, and it certainly shaped some of my thinking about this. I mean, in listening to your question, it occurs to me that one way to characterize humans is as animals with especially strong sequence learning, where the sequence learning is probably supported by our very large cortex. And the reason that that might be an interesting way of thinking about things is because, first of all, it emphasizes that we are animals, like all other animals, and especially, you know, with especially close relationships with the other higher apes, with the chimps and bonobos. You know, you can see commonalities, very strong commonalities across all mammals, and to decreasing degrees as one goes further and further abroad. Although, you know, we look at some of the very distant intelligent animals like the octopus. There maybe are commonalities that emerge once more. So that's very interesting. Peter Godfrey Smith has talked about octopus as being about as close to an alien intelligence as we can get on Earth, which I think is true. So, you know, animals in that sense, but we also are very, very strong sequence learners. And, you know, this sequence learning tasks, in other words, being able to you know, memorize, reproduce, and generalize sequences is one of the few, you know, kind of basic cognitive tasks where we really do distinguish ourselves from our near relatives. And you know, we have some circumstantial evidence that, you know, we may have been doing music and dance, for instance, long before we were even doing language. You know, a lot of those kinds of physical activities, synchronous physical activities and so on, you know, involve sequence and imitating each other. What's so interesting about models like Lambda or GPT-3 is that these are pure sequence learners. So obviously they're not animals. They don't have any of that sort of biological inheritance that we have. They are just sequence learners. That's all a transformer model is. And what is so remarkable about what happens when you take a sequence learner like that and you have it learn from the entire web, and then you prime it with, say, you know, the beginnings of a conversation, and you start having a dialogue, is that you get something out that can come pretty damn close to passing the Turing test. And I think that's very, very telling. So, you know, one of the cases that I make in the Medium essay that I wrote in December and is that sequence learning is a sufficient basis for mentalizing or theory of mind. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding, in the sense that I think that there are dialogues that, you know, pretty clearly demonstrate theory of mind in Lambda, which, you know, is a striking claim, but it's one that, you know, we do know how to test. You know, basically you cook up stories and you see whether your interlocutor is able to position themselves, you know, to model what is going on, right, in the mind of a character in a story. What do they know, what do they don't know, and so on. This underlies social intelligence and the development of sociality in humans, I believe. It underlies the capacities for teaching and learning, of political economy, division of labor. You know, almost everything that makes humans special is really enabled by theory of mind. And I think the theory of mind is in turn just about having a model of an other. And that model is supported by a sequence learner. So what that implies is that, first of all, what Kate was saying about one-sided relationships being real, I fully believe when somebody with an animist religion does sequence modeling of a river or a cloud, it imputes an intelligence there, a spirit or a god or whatever, that relationship is real. It just so happens that the river or the cloud or whatever, I don't believe, is modeling the human back, if that makes sense. So that is a one-sided relationship in the same way that, giving your old beater car the name Vivian, is a one-sided relationship. The car is not really modeling you, but you're certainly modeling it and its moods and its crankiness and so on. And when we have relationships with each other, I don't agree with the idea of calling it an illusion. It's not an illusion, but it's a mutual model, right? A is modeling B, B is modeling A, and it's in the interplay of that mutual modeling that the relationship takes place. I also believe, by the way, that we model ourselves, and that that's a social relationship as well. So A modeling A is the basis for self-consciousness. My view of what consciousness is that it's exactly about that same kind of social modeling simply applied to ourselves. We have psychological models of ourselves. That's why we're able to do things like plan for the future, do long-term planning. Again, like that we could not do that if we didn't have an internalized model of ourselves and what life will be like for us next week, if we do A or B. But of course, that model is incomplete, right? Your psychological model is nowhere even close to a literal model of all of the synapses and neurons in your brain and what they're all going to really do under various circumstances, which is also how free will emerges as a concept. I would say that free will is the gap between that high-level psychological model and, the realities of everything that, that actually takes place in the brain and the process of making decisions and all these kinds of things. And we try to keep that space inflated, partly because that allows us to have a sense of what Daniel Dennett has called elbow room and sort of optionality. And that optionality is in turn about preventing ourselves from being predicted by others. If you're a predator, you don't want to be fully predicted by the prey. If you're a prey, you don't want to be fully predicted by the predator. If you're a lover, you don't want to be fully predictable to your mate. If you're a politician, you don't want to be fully predicted. Nobody wants to become machinic. Right. And so keeping that space inflated between the reality of what you will do and one's ability to model you is that sense of elbow room. It's something that we seek.
That was really interesting, because something you just said made me think as well of the different approaches there are to these cognitive theories and the idea of the inactive approach, where your body becomes a sensor in the world, that you make sense of the world as you move through it, which, of course, an AI can't do because it has no body. We have to feed it that data. But that is also, there's a huge amount of sociality involved in that too, in the way that you interact with other creatures, not just other humans, but your whole environment. When we talk about AI not being embodied, and when you think about the things that we're trying to get it to relate to in the real world, it is embodied, that there is this ecological perspective to it. I mean, what are we actually trying to do with that AI? Are we trying to use it to track things? Are we trying to use it to sense things? Are we trying to recreate what that does? Because we're already trying to do that to some degree. So the very fact that we're using artificial neural networks is an attempt of us to mimic nature and to mimic those biological processes. We're doing it very, very crudely. But that's where we've put the base of it. So do we have to do it like that? No, not at all. We can take other approaches. We don't have to mimic what is happening in nature to try and get an understanding of nature, I don't think. I think we'd be fools to try, because nature is incredibly sophisticated, and right now we are not in comparison.
So I'm not sure that a pure language model is not embodied. I mean, when I try to think about what it would be like to be a pure language being, that has learned from nothing but language, that was how I learned English. I did it all by reading sci-fi books that were all about worlds that didn't exist and so on. I know, of course, that my ability to make any sense of that was supported by my embodiment in the world in various ways. So I'm not trying to claim that somehow didn't count for anything, but I also think that, you know, our support in an embodied world is why we're able to learn over only one lifetime and so quickly. I don't think that it necessarily proves that that's required. And in fact, the reason that it appears to take 500,000 lifetimes worth of reading, right, for language models to get it. I mean, there may be many reasons for that, including inefficient learning algorithms and what have you. But, you know, it's overwhelming amounts, right, may compensate for a lack of building up those representations based on say, you know, vision and locomotion and so on. So I do think it's a world of a kind. It's just a very, very limited one. And, you know, I don't believe that the ability to understand color relies on vision. I got in some trouble using Helen Keller's words to that effect, in my Medium piece of December, because there were some people who claimed that I was trying to somehow make a hierarchy or a chain of being in which I put disabled people closer to AI. That's absolute nonsense. I mean, my whole point is that such chains of being don't make any sense, and that there is no, you know, that we shouldn't be making such distinctions. So anyway, all of that is to say, you know, I'm not a Cartesian dualist, right? I really value our, you know, our embodiment and our bodies, and I think this is really, you know, important to being human. But I also think that there are many, many ways to be intelligent, and that saying that, you know, sense A, B, or C, or embodied property A, B, or C is necessary, well, really, if you can't prove that it's necessary, I don't believe you that it's necessary. And if we can show that intelligence can exist without, you know, this, that, or the other, then I think we have to cede the point that, you know, that these are all just, you know, additional, you know, affordances, modalities, et cetera. And, you know, and a model like DeepMind's Gato, you know, that has a sequence modeler hooked up to a robotic arm and an eye, you know, that, you know, it works and could do all these additional tasks, I think is evidence that, you know, all of these are just, you know, optional add-ons in some sense.
That's really interesting. That's got me thinking about loads of things now that I want to dive off into these tangents, and especially color. I could quite happily just talk about these color experiences for ages. I kind of wonder, do you think that you can, you kind of alluded to it, that you can model anything?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess so. What do you think wouldn't be amenable to modeling?
I don't know. I've just... because I can completely see your point that if you can convert this to a signal, it can be modeled. And then I'm trying to rack in my brain thinking, right, where would that not apply? Can it? And I guess it's those experiential things. But even then, we have sensors that can do this. So yeah, I find it fascinating.
I think that anything that we can think about, you know, we can model, because what thinking is modeling.
Yeah.
I know that makes some people uncomfortable. But that is my belief. There's a really fun experiment that you probably have heard about from the 70s. I'm not remembering now which lab did it. It would definitely not pass muster today, either from a rigor or an ethics standpoint, I think. But it involved having an attractive female experimenter interviewing men about something or other on or at the end of a very, very rickety bridge. There's the rickety bridge case high over a river, and then there's a short, sturdy bridge, and that's done in the two different bridge conditions. And the female experimenter gives the male subject her number at the end, saying, you know, if you have any further questions about it, you know, like, feel free to give me a call. And the experiment is a MacGuffin. It's you know, it's about something, you know, unrelated. And the men who go across the rickety bridge are much, much more likely to call up and maybe try and get a date as well than the ones who did this on the solid bridge that didn't create, you know, a sense of danger and physical arousal. And what I think is so interesting about that experiment is that, you know, it really reveals the way, you know, we have physiological responses to things, and our brains are busy trying to model, you know, right, those, you know, what those responses are and what they might mean. And they overinterpret, you know, just as with everything else. So, you know, the arousal of just being scared because, you know, it feels like you're about to fall You know, it's easy to confuse with the arousal of, you know, I found that person really hot or something. And I think we do that all the time. And in fact, you know, the number of physiological states that we have that we think about as being affective or emotional is probably quite a lot simpler and lower dimensional than all of the layers that we add on top of that. You know, in the same way that we add, you know, so many layers of kink and so on top of the base, you know, the basic impulses of sex. So, you know, yay for that, right? For all that complexity that gets added on top. But also, you know, it what it reveals in my thinking is how, you know, exuberant modeling is relative to the things being modeled in some cases. You know, so for me, it's less a matter of like, is there something you can't model than, you know, like the models actually exceed reality in a lot of ways, or even construct, you know, realities that were not necessarily objectively there prior to the model being formed, if that makes sense. I also, you know, had a question to ask you, basically, like, do you think that people are still going to be having physical sex in the future, or is it all over for that? You know, and what does mediation mean? You know, when it comes to intimacy, you began to get into this a little bit, you know, toward the end of your book, but I wonder if you've had, you know, ongoing thoughts about this since.
Do I think people will be physically having sex? Definitely. I don't think we're going to lose that sociality. Definitely. There's no replacing it. And so I've been recently talking about this, and people have asked us about the metaverse, saying, you know, we're all going to live in the metaverse. We won't need real world anymore. And I'm quite skeptical that the metaverse is, first of all, going to be a seamless experience people think it is. And secondly, that's going to happen in the near future. But I think there's always going to be that sociality built in all of us, the same sociality that has us wanting to befriend a voice assistant, or wanting to have a pet, or, you know, wanting to go and hug a tree in a forest. All of those things, those feelings in us, I don't think they're going to go away. And so I think that certainly sex is something so fundamentally human, whether or not you're a person who wants to have sex, or perhaps chooses not to, or perhaps really likes to, you know, that people's individual experiences vary widely. But we know that as a species, we're kind of here to spread our DNA. It's what we do. So I don't see that going away anytime.
I hope you're right.
This podcast is produced on the occasion of the Interspecies Future Symposium in July 2022, co-hosted by Light Art Space and the Museum für Naturkunde in Berlin. The symposium has been orchestrated and convened by the chairs, Kenrick Aledo McDowell and Jonathan Ledyard, with Bettina Carmes and Johannes Vogel. The wider program has been curated by Light Art Space Head of Programs Amira Gad, with Corinne Minat as co-organizer of the Interspecies Future Symposium and surrounding activities. This series is produced and hosted by me, Bridie Addison-Child. It is a reduced listening production supported by Light Art Space.